Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, March 29th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump rolls back Obama-era environmental rules.
My administration is putting an end to the war on coal. Gonna have clean coal, really clean coal.
Why Russia interfered in the U.S. election? The U.S. military likely played a role in an airstrike in Mosul that witnesses say killed civilians. Also ahead.
It's gotta be rock and roll music if you wanna dance.
Overlooked facts about the late father of pop music. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump signed a sweeping executive order Tuesday that would effectively dismantle Obama-era environmental regulations, rekindling the highly charged partisan debate about how human activity affects the Earth's climate, and deepening concern that decades of work on global climate treaties may be unraveling.
My action today is the latest in a series of steps to create American jobs and to grow American wealth. We're ending the theft of American prosperity and rebuilding our beloved country.
Trump's order will seek to suspend, rescind, or identify for review more than a half dozen rules in an attempt to increase domestic energy production in the form of fossil fuels. The rollback also scraps many of former President Barack Obama's environmental initiatives and removes the requirement that federal officials weigh the impact of climate change when making decisions.
The action I'm taking today will eliminate federal overreach, restore economic freedom, and allow our companies and our workers to thrive, compete, and succeed on a level playing field for the first time in a long time, fellas. It's been a long time.
Trump's 2018 budget proposal slashes almost all funding for climate research. Joining me now is Andrew Light, senior fellow at the World Resources Institute, a global research organization. He's also the former U.S. State Department climate official. So what is your reaction to Tuesday's executive action?
It's a disaster from the point of view of the United States working to try to be on the solution side of climate change, both domestically and globally. And it's also going to definitely threaten our ability to compete with other countries in what is, by every measure that we have on this, is an ongoing clean energy revolution happening on the planet.
The new EPA director has made statements in the past regarding carbon not being a problem.
Well, what Scott Pruitt has said is he said that he thinks that climate change is real, and he is either not certain or is skeptical that humans are the cause of climate change, and that flies in the face of every science study that's been done on this issue since 1992.
The president was surrounded by some coal miners and talked about bringing coal back. Is it even possible to do that at this point?
No, it's not. It's really something that personally troubles me quite a lot. Both of my grandfathers were coal miners in West Virginia, and I've seen the transformation in the once vibrant communities they were in, mostly due to changes in the economy and changes in technologies. So what has been really killing off the coal industry is, first of all, cheap natural gas, which is in abundance, and then also the movement from tunneling underground, which is what my grandfathers did, to mountaintop mining, which involves fewer workers. And so we've only now got about 50,000 jobs in the coal industry, whereas we have double, triple that number in renewable energy now.
As someone who worked in the State Department on this very issue of climate, where do we stand as far as national security, and is climate change, in your view, a national security issue?
It is in my view, and I think much more persuasively, it is in the view of the Department of Defense. I'm going back a couple administrations now who have described climate change as a threat multiplier, as a catalyst for conflict, as something we now have extremely well-documented examples of around the world, where humanly caused climate change is contributing to disasters. There's a great paper that was published a few years ago in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that came to the conclusion that the drought that precipitated the Syrian conflict had no natural causes. This is an entirely humanly caused drought. Now, that doesn't mean that climate change caused the Syrian conflict, but we know that it played an extremely important role in the destabilization that occurred there. The U.S. can't solve that security problem by itself, But what we are doing is making Americans less safe and making the world less safe if we're going to back away completely from all of the cooperative measures that I and my colleagues helped to create in the Obama administration to bring the world together towards solutions on climate change. So there will be a not insignificant amount of harm that will be caused by the U.S. completely stepping away from the global effort to work on this. We don't know exactly how much that is. I couldn't give you a number, but we can be certain that this is a kind of decision that's going to hurt people.
The original statements that you made regarding this is a real disaster for the United States, I'm assuming you mean overall on the world stage and economically?
You know, we don't know how other countries are going to react to the signals that were sent by the Trump administration. One thing that's important to point out is that nothing in today's executive order says one way or not whether or not the U.S. is actually going to formally stay in the Paris Climate Agreement. We expect that decision will come a little later. But it's very clear to any observer out there who understands how these things work is that we have an effective withdrawal of the United States from everything that made the Paris Climate Agreement a success. The U.S. can't get to a solution on climate change, which is a global problem by itself. It has to work with other countries. What I expect is going to happen is that other countries are now going to, frankly, start saying no to this president on his international agenda, at least, because this is a step away from the global consensus, the global community that sort of was created over the last 8 years to get this global agreement on this problem. There is another danger, which is more particular to the United States. It's mostly with respect to economic cost. So we've seen this dramatic drop in prices of renewable energy, especially wind and solar. What we are doing today by setting ourselves apart from the rest of the world is signaling that the United States doesn't want to cooperate, not only in the solution set to doing something about the problem, but also in the enormous economic opportunity that's created. And I'm quite worried that this could have some collateral damage on American businesses. Different countries around the world are going to have choices that they can make. They can turn to China, they can turn to Germany, they can turn to other countries and other companies in other countries to implement their commitments under the Paris Agreement. And I think that we're going to stand out now as a country that's not actually working with other countries to get there, and we won't reap the benefits.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Andrew Light, Senior Fellow at the World Resources Institute, a global research organization, and former U.S. State Department climate official. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. Senate ratifies Montenegro as a NATO member. The former Ivory Coast First Lady acquitted of crimes against humanity. Trump's North Korea policy, is it different from Obama's? And a new blood test rapidly diagnoses tuberculosis. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Embattled House Intelligence Committee Chairman Congressman Devin Nunes threw the committee's investigation of Russian election interference into serious doubt on Tuesday as he rejected calls for his recusal and stopped the committee's work for the rest of the week. The actions deepened the frustrations of Democratic members who say Nunes's actions jeopardized his credibility and undermined his ability to lead the investigation. At Tuesday's White House press briefing, Presidential Press Secretary Sean Spicer was clearly testy when asked by reporters about the ongoing issue of Russia and possible connections to the Trump campaign.
If the president puts Russian salad dressing on his salad tonight, somehow that's a Russian connection. But every single person... I appreciate your agenda here.
Joining me now for more on Russia's agenda is Lauren Goodrich, senior Eurasia analyst with the think tank Stratfor. What do you think about Russia's interference in our election? What do we know?
What we know is that Russia's greatest weapon at this time is not its military, is not its nuclear arsenal, but it's its far-reaching tactics of information gathering, disinformation spreading, overall propaganda machine, and its cyber capabilities. This little information package is really a great weapon that it's using all over the world right now, not just inside the United States. But the United States has been the flashiest scene that we've seen of Russia actually using this machine that it's built. For Russia, I mean, it's not about being pro-Trump. It's about being pro, can we get someone in that will reshape our relations, or can we at least just disrupt the U.S. political process to the point where Washington's only focusing on Washington and not Moscow?
Right.
And that,
right.
I think, was the real key for Russia going into this.
What do you think we still need to know regarding all of this?
Well, the biggest problem we have is we know there were meetings. That's not a question, and it's not illegal to have meetings. The question is was there from the United States side any actual deal-making, or were they just hearing the Russians out? And that's the problem that we're facing right now, is we're not getting answers on what was actually said inside these meetings, and were these people making deals to go along with the Kremlin agenda?
Do you think we'll find out?
The problem is that Russia is really savvy on this, and so I'm not sure if we're going to uncover all the seeds, even if we find out within the very public meetings that happened. There's probably layers upon layers even deeper that we haven't uncovered yet, because that's how the Russians play. They play chess. We don't know everything that they've planted within our current political landscape, because they are so good at it.
Well, we know that Vladimir Putin really did not like Hillary Clinton, did want to do her some damage. He definitely succeeded, but from my understanding, he didn't really expect that she would lose the election, but maybe he would just weaken her. So now that he actually has Donald Trump, and with all the drama surrounding and intrigue surrounding what's been happening and the investigations, do you think maybe he did overplay his hand and could be either regretful or sort of not knowing how to deal with what's happening now?
Very much so. Moscow achieved its chaos and its disruptive campaigns that it has planted in many other countries around the world. However, Russia did not expect the blowback that they're receiving right now. And I think it's because with the new administration, it was a complete unknown. At least with Clinton, it was a known for the Kremlin, and they knew how to play the game after if she had won. With Trump, he's a complete unknown, and Russia wasn't prepared for that and wasn't prepared for it kind of creating a domino effect of then sparking this backlash against it. The Kremlin didn't think that relations could actually get poorer between the U.S. and Russia, and we're now starting to see that with the sentiment that is really driving the political machine inside the United States right now. I think that the Kremlin believes it had a really grand opportunity to reshape relations with Washington over Ukraine and sanctions and NATO buildups in its borderlands. And now everything is kind of an unknown for the Kremlin, which is why I think we've seen the Kremlin get really kind of quiet on issues of the United States, and they really wait for the new administration to kind of give guidance on how they're going to handle it before the Kremlin will respond.
It's interesting, though, you know, you say it's made things worse, but we still have not heard really a negative word from President Trump about Russia.
We have to kind of take the rhetoric aside, away from the actions that we've seen as well. I mean, we haven't seen sanctions lifted, and people tried to kind of loop, you know, our Secretary of State Tillerson into the pro-Russian camp, but he's really not. I mean, he's very hard on Vladimir Putin and actually stood up to Putin in the years that he was with ExxonMobil inside of Russia and really said, sorry, if you're going to bully us, we're just going to leave. So I feel like we're waiting for the actions to actually come out of Trump's decision to warm relations with Russia. I think Tillerson's trip to Moscow will be very defining on giving us a roadmap on which way things are going to actually be going.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Secretary Tillerson's trip to Moscow. There's been a lot of comments about why he would choose to go to Moscow, to Russia, over going to NATO meetings. That in itself sort of has not the greatest visual given what's been going on.
Visually, and the messaging of it, of course, is not what our NATO allies want to see. However, Tillerson initially decided to skip the NATO meeting in order to co-host the Chinese leadership, which really shows the priority of the new administration, like really wanting to deal with trade in China. Signals that the new administration is very serious and sees China kind of as our top rival at this time, not the issues that NATO's dealing with and not Russia. And that's a very big message to say that Russia is not our top priority at this time as far as enemies go.
Do we know why he's going to Moscow, what he's planning on doing, who he's planning on meeting with?
Not said that he's going to be meeting with Putin himself yet. It would be surprising to me if he didn't, because they do have that personal relationship. And so I think that this is going to start to lay the groundwork on how they're going to be able to work together within the limits of having such a rabidly anti-Russian Congress and Senate and sentiment within the United States right now.
All right. We appreciate your perspective and taking the time to talk to us. Lauren Goodrich, she's the senior Eurasia analyst with the think tank Stratfor. U.S. defense officials have been reviewing hundreds of video files of coalition airstrikes to determine whether a massive blast on March 17th that destroyed several buildings in western Mosul, killing up to 150 civilians, could have been from a strike targeting Islamic State fighters. Army Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, the commander leading the counter-Islamic State fight in Iraq and Syria, told reporters in a conference call from Baghdad on Tuesday that Iraqi military leaders firmly believe that civilians were gathered by Islamic State ahead of the strike, possibly for the extremists to use as human shields.
If we did it, and I'd say there's at least a fair chance that we did, it was an unintentional accident of war, and we will transparently report it to you when we're ready.
Well, Nate Rabkin is managing editor of the website Inside Iraqi Politics. Speaking to VOA's Victor Beatty from Tel Aviv, Rabkin explained the circumstances surrounding the mysterious blast last week, pieced together by media reports.
It seems this was a house of a wealthy individual, a large family house, and the owner had invited in many refugees who he was hosting there and, you know, providing shelter and food to. Fighters from ISIS set up on the roof of this building. And so when the building was targeted with an airstrike, it ended up killing a lot of the people sheltering inside. And one of the things that's not clear among many questions, it seems that, you know, there may have been explosives or car bombs or something of this nature emplaced by ISIS either in or next to the building that may have added to the damage from the airstrike.
So are you saying for sure you know that it was an airstrike because U.S. authorities are investigating?
I suppose it's not entirely clear. The Iraqi military has issued a statement suggesting that maybe it wasn't. Their investigation suggests that it was just ISIS bombs and explosives that somehow went off, destroying the building. I suspect that an airstrike was involved. That seems to be the consensus of reports coming out from people in Mosul. But no, nothing's certain yet.
This deputy commander said that Islamic State militants decided sometime in mid-March that, quote, they were going to prepare lethal engagement areas for defense of the terrain, that they would clear out homes, schools, and mosques and fight from those positions and deny the Iraqis from advancing any further.
Yes. The way ISIS fights, they use a lot of bombs and booby traps in civilian areas. It inflicts a very grim toll on people who live there.
If the U.S. is responsible for this, would this be a real PR disaster for their efforts to retake Mosul?
I'm not sure of that. The Iraqi military's claim that this was not a U.S. airstrike carries a certain amount of weight, at least in a big segment of Iraqi media. That may continue to dominate the narrative, even if the U.S. investigation finds something else. I think the other thing that's important to keep in mind is, yeah, there are a lot of people in Iraq who have a lot of bad memories of coalition airstrikes, U.S. airstrikes in the past. I'm not sure that this particular incident makes a big change to how the debate unfolds in Iraqi media and among the Iraqi public.
Well, the rights group Amnesty International interviewed civilian survivors and witnesses who said hundreds of people were killed by airstrikes inside their homes and places they had sought refuge after government forces told them not to leave. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
International Edition continues now with a check on what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by Andrew Palchevsky. Andrew, what's the word on the Twitter sphere today?
Well, following the terror attack in London last week, there's a new push in the UK for access to encrypted information from social media. And you have Amber Rudd, who's the UK Home Secretary, saying that the country's intelligence services should be able to access encrypted messages from WhatsApp, which were apparently used as part of that attack. So, in fact, this week, British officials are going to go and meet with some of the leaders from some of these companies, including Facebook, who owns WhatsApp. And they're going to talk about how they can have some information sharing to work on preventing terrorism and hate speech. Now, this is interesting because, as you might remember, back in December 2015 here in the U.S. in San Bernardino, California, there was a shooting where 14 people were killed in an ISIS-inspired attack. And that kicked off a whole debate as the FBI wanted to get into the shooter's iPhone. And Apple said it wasn't going to decrypt the phone. There was a big back and forth about that. So this seems to be kicking up now in the United Kingdom. There may be a similar debate about this, although right now it looks like the tech companies are looking to work with governments to try to prevent these things. But when I heard this story, I thought back to that case in San Bernardino and how this might spark some issues and some debate about encryption and privacy and security, particularly with social media.
No kidding, for sure. And what else are people talking about?
Well, there's a big push by Facebook to release some new tools that may look similar if you use Snapchat. Now, we've talked in the past about how Facebook tried to buy Snapchat. They were unsuccessful in doing so. Snapchat has since become a huge success in social media. Well, Facebook's releasing a number of different elements that are similar. One called Camera. It's going to allow people to take pictures and send them, similar to how Snapchat works. And in fact, part of that camera feature, you're going to have something they're going to call lenses, which sound a lot like Snapchat's filters. You can take a photo and put different lenses over your photos of different facial hair or facial, you know, whether it's big eyes or hats or other things like that. Very similar to Snapchat. The other is Stories, similar to what they do with Instagram. Of course, Facebook also owns Instagram. Seems like Facebook owns just about everything these days.
Right?
That's how they got to be the multi-billion dollar company they are. But Stories was actually rolled out on Instagram and would be incorporated into Facebook. And similar to Snapchat, would have these stories show up for a little while and then disappear. And then finally, Direct, allowing users to send photos and video directly to their friends that they specify and not broadcast them out to everyone. So looks like Facebook's taking a couple pages out of Snapchat's book. Snapchat is being used by more and more people. Facebook is trying to stay relevant, especially with younger crowds. So perhaps not surprising that they're doing this. I would be curious to see, however, if Snapchat has any issue with this, especially because some of these are very, very similar, if maybe there's some legal action or at least some complaining on the part of Snapchat.
Okay. Well, we appreciate it. Thanks so much, Andrew. We will see. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, as tributes continue to pour in following the death of pop music founding father Chuck Berry, who died March 18th at the age of 90, VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald tells VOA's Jim Stevenson why Chuck Berry was so revered.
We have lost one of the greats, Chuck Berry.
Chuck was a huge favorite of mine. His songs were so witty. That's what I always loved about them. They were funny, they were perceptive, and then, of course, he was a great guitar player and songwriter, and he created what we think of as rock and roll. I think of him as the father of rock. Elvis was the first rock star, but Chuck had put the building blocks in place. And what I want to talk about today is what made Chuck Berry Chuck Berry. He passed away, of course, on March 18th. He was 90 years old, and tributes have been pouring in from all over the world about his artistry. But what about Chuck Berry the man? Well, he was a complicated person. And I think a lot of that sprang from his upbringing. He was born in Missouri in 1926 into a segregated society. As a teenager, he spent 3 years in reform school, and he worked as a beautician before he seriously got into music in the 1950s. And when Chuck really got rolling in the mid to late 50s, he was already in his 30s. He was a good 10 years older, for instance, than Elvis or some of his other early rock contemporaries. So that was a differentiating factor. He also was a great observer of American life at all levels. He sang about teenage life, and he sang with no accent. So it was very clear to people what he was singing about. And he had a style that translated and traveled well, which is why people across the country and across the Atlantic, in England especially, really took to his stuff. And he became the mentor for an entire generation of white rock heroes, like the Beatles, the Beach Boys, and the Rolling Stones. But this developed into a situation where they were actually ripping him off. He successfully sued the Beach Boys for ripping off his song Sweet Little 16 and their song Surfin' USA. His manager brought a copyright infringement against John Lennon for the Beatles song Come Together, which incorporated elements of Chuck's song You Can't Catch Me. That was settled out of court. So Chuck was very ambivalent about the rock stars who praised him because, you know, they were taking money from him. And his career had been derailed in the late 50s when he was imprisoned for 20 months for taking an underage girl across state lines for what were deemed immoral purposes. Chuck's glory years were from about 1955 to 59. After he got out of prison, he began recording again, and he encountered some success. And his one and only U.S. number one single, My Ding-a-Ling, came out in 1972. But these were just footnotes. I mean, Chuck Berry is remembered for the genius songs that he wrote in the 1950s.
They say sometimes imitation is the most sincerest form of flattery, and certainly most artists did, in fact, imitate Chuck in some form or another throughout the years.
They sure did.
Well, Ray, we are so thrilled to have you with us each and every week. Our Top 20 Countdown host. You can hear Ray at VOA1 and also follow him on Twitter.
Ray on the hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Any old time you use it, it's got to be rock and roll music. If you want to dance with me, if you want to dance with me. Well, I'm going to write a little letter. I'm going to mail it to my local DJ.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition, and that does it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Keep a singing the blues. Roll over Beethoven, tell Tchaikovsky the news. I got the rockin' pneumonia, I need a shot of rhythm and blues. I caught the rolling off the rider sitting down at a rhythm review. I roll over Beethoven, they're rocking in two by two. Well, if you feel it and like it, go get your lover, then reel and rock.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson recently underscored that human rights is integral to American foreign policy, noting that our values are our interests when it comes to human rights. In support of this interest, Congress mandates the State Department report every year on the human rights situation in countries around the world. These reports underscore our commitment to freedom, democracy, and the human rights guaranteed to all individuals around the world, including in Vietnam. While there has been some progress in recent years, there continue to be serious concerns about the human rights situation in Vietnam. The recently released human rights report for Vietnam highlights these continuing challenges. Among these were the Vietnamese government's continued restriction of citizens' political rights and fundamental freedoms of assembly, association, and expression. While many millions of Vietnamese retain access to the internet and social media sites, the government continued to exercise various forms of control over internet access. There was a significant increase in 2016 in the number of convictions of activists for peacefully expressing their views. There is also inadequate protection of citizens' due process rights, including protection against arbitrary detention. The State Department report highlighted problems of judicial independence and transparency, and detailed a number of instances over the past year where Vietnamese citizens were denied the right to a fair and expeditious trial. The Vietnamese government continued to constrain civil society in other ways as well, including by censoring the press and restricting the activities of NGOs. It is important that the government of Vietnam strengthen protection for human rights, religious freedom, and the rule of law. Doing so will bolster Vietnam's economy, help its people reach their full potential, and facilitate a deeper bilateral partnership with the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.